Good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, whoever you are, or whoever you may be, depending on your time of day. This is Coast to Coast, and welcome back to all of you out there in the world, or whatever time zone you are. It's so good to be back. It's been a long time. In February was the last we were on. February 11th. Well, I can't imagine the last 2 months with social distancing and staying home and staying safe with the unemployment rate going up and death tolls going high, reaching almost 30,000. The president said that he disagreed with former President George W. Bush's stance on COVID-19. Other news, nothing new and exciting. To all those sports fans out there, we have no idea when baseball will return or when basketball returns. But the NFL schedule comes out later this week. Well, let's get back to our routine where we left off. That was Matthew Alford's God Part of the Brain. That was February 11th. So, stay right there. We're going to get back to another edition of God. Be ready. Holding on Coast to Coast with DZ and Art Bell. Welcome back.
If I could read
Coast to Coast. Easy. And Art Bell.
Just like
you can listen to the past podcast, past episodes on Anchor, iTunes, Stitcher app, or whatever app you have. Coming up. God Part of the Brain, Part 2 with Matthew
Alford. Because the ending just too hard to take.
Wanna take a ride? From the high desert and the great American Southwest, exclusively on Sirius XM Radio, this is Dark Matter with your host, Art Bell. Now, here's Art.
Good evening and welcome to Extra Terrestrial Radio. This is Dark Matter, and I am Art Bell. It's great to be here. I want to say right away that if your religious sensibilities are offended easily, please leave. Just turn off the radio and go away. If, on the other hand, you're intellectually challenged and your faith can take a little challenge and hold up, well, stay where you are. But, you know, if you're going to cry like a baby, run. That's just a little warning before the show tonight. A few things, actually quite a few things, before we get to Matthew Alford. I got an email, which I kind of liked. Art, I had a dream or a nightmare after last night's show. Art, it was that a meteor was heading straight for Earth, and NASA developed a plan to change its trajectory just by enough to make it miss Earth by a few miles. But about 10 minutes before it was going to pass Earth, NASA notified the world that they'd screwed up on their original calculations, and the meteor was actually going to miss Earth with no interference from man. But because of their error in calculations, it was now going to impact Earth. So it was going to pass on by, but since we screwed with it, we all died. There was a big flash, and then I woke up. Bad nightmare. Good show, though, Art. Sorry about that. And this I was shocked, surprised, and happy to see. The way the planets influence the flow of dark matter into the sun now may explain one of the biggest mysteries in science, say particle physicists. The sun's 11-year cycle is one of science's greatest mysteries. Astronomers have watched in fascination for centuries now as the number of sunspots increases and then decreases over a regular cycle of almost exactly 11 years. More recently, they seem to have discovered that at the same time, the sun's visible light luminosity changes about 10 to the minus 3, while its X-ray luminosity changes by a factor of 100. So anyway, they're saying that sunspots coming and going, the 11-year cycle, is all produced by what else? Dark matter. Go, dark matter. Here's somebody listening to Shostak, Seth Shostak last night. It reminds me of something I'd read about Thomas Jefferson. Back in his day, nobody understood meteors, and scientists didn't believe that, even firsthand reports. At some point, a couple of scientists from Harvard, I believe, tracked a meteor, recovered it, and proceeded to tell everybody about it. Jefferson's response was, "I'd sooner believe two Harvard doctors are lying than to believe rocks fall out of the sky." I value SETI, but you know, they're searching time as well as space, and they don't know what they're looking for. Thinking that advanced societies use lots of energy is kind of like a 19th century cowboy wondering about the horse poop problem in 21st century New York. I had a lot of a wormhole stuff about Seth not believing in UFOs and all the rest of it. It's okay. I'm on to Shostak. All right. You now have a very good reason to go to artbell.com. I really got a good story up there for you. You remember the other night I mentioned that two hydrogen bombs had been mistakenly dropped on North Carolina? Didn't go off. Save for one little safety feature that had 3 or 4 volts in the right way and didn't change. There were 4 safety things that would keep a bomb from going off after a B-52 disintegrates in midair and the bombs drop. And 3 of the fail-safes. Well, the whole story was sent to me by a listener early today. I've had Keith post it at artbell.com. Imagine that. All those years later, they say, oops, we dropped a couple of hydrogen bombs. Now, hydrogen bombs are really big. These would have been about 200 times bigger than Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So, in other words, goodbye a lot of the East Coast and goodbye forever. Or at least, you know, many, many, many generations. You were about 3 volts or 4 volts separated from eternity. You can read about it on my website if you want. Oh, the 90-minute cutoff. Well, this continues to be something that SiriusXM is working on. They said they will look into it for you. I even had somebody say, you know, I downloaded something on demand or whatever it was, and it's still cut off. That's really crazy. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens. They're working on it, doing the best they can. Remember I said that I think people are afraid of comets because it's in our DNA? I do believe that, by the way. I think that we have an innate fear of comets, And I think it's from something that happened to man long ago, and it's in our DNA. Matthew Alper will like that concept because he thinks God is in our DNA, too. Now, somebody writes, art being scared of things we don't quite understand or things out of the ordinary is a trait left over from evolution for survival. Our ancestors from eons ago needed things like this to stay alive. Weird-looking animal with big fangs, stay away. Mountain man shooting flaming hot liquid, strange, stay away. Another one is kids being afraid of the dark. What do you mean, kids? I still don't. Anyway, what is that? Well, way back when things still went bump in the night, as if they don't now, if an infant was left alone in the dark, they should be so scared they remained silent. And then I really want to note this. The best book I ever read in my life was called Gravity. It was by a gal named Kes Gerritsen that I interviewed here on the air. Long-time listeners, you'll remember it. A lot of you, I bet, read that book. And a lot of you probably now are thinking, wow, it was made into a movie. No, There is a movie coming out about called Gravity. And strangely, it has a female up in a space station, just like the book we read. And yet, it is not Tess Gerritsen's book. Just so you know, ahead of time, and you don't go running in to see it because you read Tess's book. Not the same. The Navy Yard gunman says that it was ELF that made him do it. Extremely low frequencies. We know that low frequencies do affect humans. However, he was also, I had heard, hearing voices. So I'd worry more about the hearing voices part of it. As Al-Qaeda linked terrorists threw grenades, oh, I'm switching over here to real news, and fired automatic weapons, the three plainclothes Kenyan police officers, lightly armed, wearing no bulletproof vests whatsoever, helmets, no other protective gear, worked their way to the roof of Nairobi's Westgate Mall, and led a group of frightened shoppers to safety. Some malls around the world, by the way, have been scrambling now to add security. Mall guards. You have to wonder, more mall guards. The Iranian president declares he's ready to talk about nuclear stuff. The earthquake in Pakistan, 7.7, I believe it was, raised an island. People were up and walking around on it today. They say it may stay or may not stay. It was stone and bubbling gas came up out of the seabed. Interesting times we live in, right? With a few words in a largely conciliatory speech to the United Nations, Iran's new president took aim at an Israeli fear, that international pressure on Iranian nuclear programs could lead to scrutiny of Israel's own secretive nuclear facilities. And I'm, you know, speaking of things nuclear, how's this for a headline? Nuclear experts, colon, Fukushima Unit 4 has shown signs of collapsing. Underneath buildings, it's become saturated. Known fractures in soil. Large structure already went down at plant after ground was super saturated and had mudslide in March of 2011. So if number 4's holding apparatus should collapse, that's really, really, really bad news for all of us, potentially. We're going to have some more guests on that kind of thing. What's going on at Fukushima, I have this definite sense, and I'm sure you do too, that we're not being told the whole story. What do you think? Well, all right, coming up in a moment, Matthew Alper. All right, here we go. You've been warned. Matthew Alper attended Vassar and graduated from sunny Stony Brook with a B.A. in philosophy. He worked as a history teacher, that's right, a history teacher in the Brooklyn Projects, a tutor in the Philippines. We'll have to talk about that. And this one we'll really have to talk about. A truck smuggler in Central Africa. That's where his career peaked.
We're going to take a break.
A produced screenwriter in Germany from whence he returned to New York City to write what he can... considered to be his life's work, The God Part of the Brain. Since its initial publication in 1996, Alper's work has been applauded by prominent scientists, academics, and Pulitzer Prize winners. He has been cited in numerous magazines, appeared on a variety of radio and TV shows, lectured all across the U.S., and can be seen in the acclaimed featured documentary, The Nature of Existence. His book is now in 7 languages and has a fan base that extends around the globe. Moreover, The God Part of the Brain is the first book written on the subject and is considered a pioneer work in the new field of study known as neurotheology. And, of course, I want to congratulate him on his recent conversion to becoming a Southern Baptist. What a shock. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I expected more. Southern Baptist, right? No, huh?
Well, I've been doing a lot of speaking in tongues, so...
actually, Matthew is an atheist. Am I right?
This is correct.
Yeah, an atheist. Matthew, at the beginning of the program here, first of all, it's great to hear you. I guess I ought to get that in. It's been a lot of years, right?
A lot of years, 13, 14, 15 years ago. A third of my life ago, we spoke.
Oh, my God, was it that long?
It was.
All right. Define for me atheist.
Somewhat. Well, actually, there are numerous interpretations. I take a kind of hard-line approach. My definition of atheism is someone who not only does not believe in God, but does not believe in a spiritual realm, period. See, I've gone to like atheist conventions and spoken, and you get a lot of like rah-rah, down with religion, down with the church and the Pope and whatnot, and even down with God. But then if I start probing and asking, like, well, who here thinks that they have a soul, hands will still go up. And I'm like, that's not my atheism.
So your hardline atheist means... no spiritual stuff at all. Zero, zip, Buddhists, go away. Everything, I don't care what religion you are, you're not interested.
Well, I basically believe in the physical realm. I don't believe that there's any type of transcendental reality that supersedes the physical.
Are you sure? Are you sure about the physical?
Well, I mean, ultimately, I have to go with Socrates. All I know is I know nothing at all. But if I even know anything of anything, I would say that I do believe that there's a physical reality. But sure, this could all be a dream.
Yeah, if you found out the whole thing was a matrix, I bet you'd be ticked off.
I mean, I could wake up tomorrow and find out I'm Art Bell.
I didn't say nightmare. All right, so you believe in essentially nothing. That's fair to say. Nothing spiritual. Nothing that... So then when you wake up in the morning, what gets you going?
Well, that's an easy answer. Coffee. Next question.
Okay. Where to go from there? You threw everybody away. All right. The reason you're here, I mean, we're going to break tonight into 2 parts, I guess, because you wrote another book. Am I correct?
Yes. Though, you know, we can sort of sum that one up more easily. You know, there's so much to cover. It took like eight shows together, 3 to 4 hours each, to get through The God Part of the Brain. So I'm all revved up and ready to tackle that one. But I'd be glad to discuss Icarus of Brooklyn, A Spiritual Quest Gone Wrong, the prequel to God Part, how I came to writing this book, my own sort of spiritual journey gone awry.
All right. There's a couple things I do want to cover before we get to that. One is, you were a tutor in the Philippines? Where in the Philippines?
Mostly in Zamboanga City, which is...
Really? Hey, have you seen what's going on there in Zamboanga?
Not recently. This was years ago. This was like even before, you know, before I wrote God Part or anything. But even then, it was one of the bases for Abu Sayyaf, which was Al-Qaeda in the Pacific.
And yeah, but right now there's a full-out battle going on there, buddy. Refugees are pouring out. The army's in. They're trying to... Mm-hmm. It's horrible. It's yeah. just a mess right now.
Right. Well, even then, the papers were like every day there was, you know, a ongoing beheading. Abu Sayyaf would kidnap the son of some rich family, hold them for ransom, yeah. and whether the ransom was paid or not, they would still behead them just to get.
Yeah, that's right. I call it headshot country.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long were you in the Philippines?
Like 5 months. Not too long.
5 months.
Yeah.
Okay. I was there for years.
Oh, really?
Anyway, yes, and then you went from being a tutor, which was nice, teaching English, I'm sure, right?
Tutoring the son of the family that I was staying at.
Oh,
nice. I was to be the Aristotle to his Alexander.
I see. Right. We got to talk a little bit about this truck smuggler thing in Central Africa. How did you come to that?
Well, that was after I was teaching fifth grade in Brooklyn and decided to take off for a year with a friend of mine. And I had gone on a journey after college where I started in Egypt and ended up in Sudan, and there was a meningitis outbreak, had to sort of turn around and never finished the trip, which was supposed to be to South Africa, and kind of weighed on my mind that it was something that I would eventually like to complete. And I was able to convince a friend that it was a wise thing to do. So we took off for a year and we hooked up with some Brits and started in London. And by the time we got to Burkina Faso, I ended up meeting these Dutch people. We bought a 1952 fire engine from them, and me and my friend Ben decided to continue the journey on our own. And about four countries later in Togo, the truck was breaking down. We were breaking down. We realized there was no way the two of us were going to make it to South Africa, so we started looking around for buyers. And the next thing we knew, we were dealing with these black market characters from Nigeria, and it kind of went from there.
Yeah, I know a lot of fifth grade teachers that have gone on to smuggle trucks in Central Africa.
Yeah, I know. It's an old story.
Jeez. you've had some adventures in life, and I have too. It's it makes life a lot more interesting.
Exactly. Whether there's a God or no God, adventures make life worth living. So.
All right, your phone line is wonderful, but you're kind of coming and going. Try and stay.
Okay.
I haven't
moved, but you let me know. I want it to sound loud and clear.
Yeah. It is loud and clear. It just sounds like you get louder sometimes, and then you get away from the phone a little, and then.
Okay.
All right, so I guess we asked how you first came to write a book like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, to refer back to this new book, Icarus of Brooklyn, which is broken into three parts, childhood, adolescence, and adulthood, which is really early adulthood. The book actually only takes me to my 20th year. And it was basically about myself on a quest because I was a curious child. And the moment I kind of put together the fact that, you know, we're all going to die, I had questions. And I was very driven by those questions, probably more than most. And, you know, ended up with a degree in philosophy, which really didn't answer any of my questions. So it was sort of my life's quest. Like I'm sure many people, and I eventually resigned myself to the fact that my life quest probably had no answer, at least one that I would ever resolve within my lifetime. But I continued, I persevered, and I continued, I was leaning towards the sciences at that point, and I continued reading as much science as I could get my hands on, from atomic physics to microbiology to cosmology. I wanted to, you know, leave no stone unturned. And somewhere around like age 29, 30, I sort of had a little bit of an epiphany. And
did this quest that you were on through college, and then as you just described, did it include investigation of religion?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was studying world religion, world mythology, I was dropping every psychedelic drug under the sun to see if I could transcend. I was meditating.
It's helpful in seeing something, I guess. I don't know. But I'm not sure that it'll lead you to God.
Right. It led me to altered states of consciousness, but it never led me to anything that seemed like a definitive proof. Actually, I mean, at about age 30, at that point, I was living in Germany working as a screenwriter. And things were going well, but there was always that thorn in the back of my head just sort of nagging, like, you still haven't figured out God, and you probably never will. But I actually kind of stopped asking. I was just like, all right, philosophies for children, time to put all that aside and, like, become a member of society, get a roof over my head, pay bills and whatnot. And one night I was working on a screenplay and I was sitting at the computer and I don't know, for whatever reason, I was like, you know what, it's been probably a good 5 years since I gave any attention to this question. So I thought, you know what, maybe every 5 years I'll come back to it. So I typed that on the computer. In the last 5 or so years, have I come any closer to coming across anything I could say definitive about God? Realized there wasn't really anywhere to go. And I was like, no, I haven't seen any miracles, you know, no visions, no, none of the above.
In other words, to believe you were going to need, I don't know, parting of at least a big lake.
Something like that, at least a big lake. And then I had my moment where I looked at the sentence and I said, aha, there is something I can say definitive about God.
And that is?
It's a word. It's sitting on the computer in front of me. It can be read. In Braille, it can be touched. It can be heard. And moreover, it's a word that seems to exist in every culture on this planet. So I thought to myself, okay, I've got all this science under my belt. Let's go back a step. What does science have to say about words? Well, they're a human concoction that comes from the brain. And here's a word that comes from the brains of every culture from the beginning of man, no matter how isolated. People found in caves, people out in the jungles of every continent. They look up to the sky and they pray to something. So I said, okay.
But I would think initially that would push you toward an investigation of why almost the whole world is worshiping one way or the other.
Absolutely. Well, right. The universality was an important factor. So I said, okay, well, what does science say about words? Well, they come from the brain. And what does science say about words or anything for that matter that exists cross-culturally? Well, it's an inherited instinct, and thus began the quest for the God part of the brain, the part of the brain that compels us to believe in and perceive some transcendental quality in the world, to as a coping mechanism, to help us survive our unique awareness of death. Now, I'm jumping ahead of myself here, but...
No, it's all right. That's the very center of what you're talking about here. You think that our brain concocts God, or that it may even be we may be genetically disposed to do so, as a result of the innate fear, the overwhelming fear of mortality.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that basically, with the evolution of self-conscious awareness, which was the trait that made humans the most powerful species on Earth, it's what distinguished us from all other animals. Now, there are a few things that distinguish us from all other animals. There's our language abilities, our musical abilities, our math abilities, a variety of functions that emerged in the neocortex during the hominid evolution.
Right.
However, the one that stood out to me as the most interesting and the most compelling was self-conscious awareness. We're the only animal that recognize our own reflections, that can contemplate the meaning of existence and our place in it, that are aware of our own destinies and our own mortality, that basically can experience existential angst, the knowledge that we and all of our loved ones are one day going to die.
But again, you're saying it is that fear, the fear of mortality, of dying.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is
that causes us to reach out somehow or another and latch on to the concept of God.
Okay, close, but not not totally the picture, because what I'm saying is that as we were evolving as an animal during the hominid evolution, the various stages we went through of primitive man, from Homo erectus to Neo Australopithecus and all of those sub-creatures that came before us, that as we were evolving and we evolved this sense of self-conscious awareness, that once we became aware of our own mortality, even though, again, it made us the most powerful species on Earth, which is an important part of the formula, because it enabled us the power of self-modification. Because from now on, because we are aware of ourselves, let's say it gets cold, we don't have to wait like all the other species and sit back dumbly and wait for natural selection to give us a thicker coat of fur 5 million years later. We can say, ooh, I'm cold, and we can sew ourselves a coat in an hour. So we've been able to transform the planet as a result of that one trait, self-conscious awareness. But the drawback was it made us aware of our mortalities. And the anxiety that came, the existential angst that came with that awareness, I'm suggesting was so powerful, so overwhelming, that it may have wiped out the species had nature not selected a cognitive modification. Basically, a part of the brain that compels us to believe that there's this other realm out there, so that we now feel that even though the physical body will die, that this other part, this spirit, will persevere and live forevermore. So it basically is a coping mechanism. It alleviates the horror of knowing that we're going to lose everything we have. With other species, they can fight or flee their fears. There's nowhere to run or fight against death. So I'm suggesting that we are now hardwired. Our species has parts of our, just like we have parts of our brain that are responsible for musical consciousness, language intelligence, that if you damage those parts, you'll lose your musical ability or your language ability. Our abilities aren't connected to the brain. I'm suggesting that there are parts of the brain that just as physical and compel us to have this belief that there's this other realm out there. And which is basically what has birthed every religion and mythology from the history of man. So it's not like it compels us to believe. Our brains, it's wired into us. It's part of the software in our heads to have this sensibility. Like you're talking about the Matrix. If there was one of the plugs in the Matrix that was like a religion plug that basically had us perceiving reality from this peculiar bent that there's something else. And it kind of allowed us to deal with death and move on, you know. So that's what I'm suggesting, that it's wired into us. It's not like a decision we make.
All right, there have been a lot of years that have gone by since you presented this. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's fair to ask you, MRIs, various ways of looking at the brain when people pray, when they're in meditative states.
Mm-hmm.
There must be some, by now, physical evidence for this God part of the brain, right?
Heaps of it. I'm ready with all of it. My arsenal is prepared.
Oh, well, then put something into the bow and let go.
Okay. Well, I basically break the argument into four major points, or at least the proofs for it. The sociobiological, the neurophysiological, the genetic, and what I call the ethnobotanical.
That all sounds really complicated.
So. No, I'll simplify it. I'll make it.
No. Simplify it after the break. We're gonna take a quick break here, actually about 5 minutes. So relax and come back with your proof. All right. That's Matthew Alpert. And I warn you. Remember, I warned you. On top of everything else, he's got a New York accent. So beware of the Alpert. Want to convert you. Hi, everybody. My guest is Matthew Alper, and he has written books some time ago called Sweet Dreams Are Made of This. No. The God part of the brain is fascinating, and the reason I'm having him back is I don't completely disagree with him, nor do I completely agree with him. Actually, to make myself clear, my attitude is this. Kind of believe in God. However, you know, 68 years old now, contemplating my own mortality could occur any minute. And I sort of feel this way. If there's a God, that's cool. and I'm looking forward to it. If there isn't, then I'll never be disappointed. I'll never know anything. It'll just be blackness, kind of like when you go to sleep, right? You're in a good, deep sleep, and there'll be nothing. So either there's a God, and it's time for a party on up, or there's not, and I won't miss a thing. Matthew, that's kind of where I stand. Now, you stand firmly on the, no, there's no God, or even spiritual stuff is out. Actually, all of it's bunk. So we were getting to the the proof part of this, and so proceed.
Okay. I may have thrown out a few fancy words. If I do, I will make sure to explain them. They're easily simplified. So let's start with the sociobiological argument. Sociobiology is basically, it's a science. It's a sort of modern twist on basic Darwinian evolutionary theory. And it basically suggests, whereas Darwinian theory says that any trait that's universal to any species must have a genetic component. So the fact that all cats have whiskers or a tail, or that humans have a nose in the middle of their face, it's not a coincidence. It's because it's in our genetic code, somewhere in our chromosomes, or what we could call nose genes, or basically, you know, every part of us, skin genes, eye genes.
Yep. That's fair.
Okay. Right. Otherwise, it would all be chaos. It would just be an accident. We'd all be jumbled up, and there wouldn't be such a thing as species. Right. So, sociobiology basically just says the same thing is true. The same principle applies to universal behaviors. So, for instance, the fact that all dogs bark, or cats meow, or beavers build dams, or honeybees build hexagonal-shaped honeycombs, all of these very specific behaviors, from the zigzag dance of certain fish, which is a 37-degree angle, and then they turn a 41-degree angle, and that's how they mate. Very specific behaviors that are universal to these species, again, suggest that these are built into the animals, part of the...
What was that? That was 41 degrees, was that?
Yes, 41 degrees.
41 degrees. I sometimes make
41 degrees. I think that's the stickleback.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, maybe you're part stickleback. Essentially, so the rule applies for any universal behavior of any species. It means that there must be a part of the brain, because that's where behavior comes from, that generates that specific behavior. And if there's a part of the brain, that would mean there must be genes responsible for making that part of the brain. So, for instance, the fact that all cats meow, even if you took a kitten away from its parents at birth and raised it by a human, it's still going to grow up to meow. So it's not a learned behavior. It's built into the animal.
Okay. Here's the problem I see with this theory.
Okay.
You're the problem.
Okay, well, that's nothing new, but how so?
Well, I mean, you're suggesting to me that no matter what, these genetic traits are going to drive you to do certain things, or to be a certain way, or to look a certain way, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You're making this absolute argument. Well, here comes Matthew Alper, and you're not living up to it.
How so? Well, basically what I'm suggesting...
What do you mean, how so? Come on.
I'm trying.
You don't believe any of this. You're saying everybody is driven universally.
Okay, we'll get there.
All right, well, so get there.
Leaping down ahead of the picture here. Let's start with sociobiology. So,
well, I had to complain a little.
Okay. So, essentially, let's take, for instance, with humans, the fact that every human culture, no matter how isolated, is communicated through language, basically suggesting that we are a linguistic animal. It's part of our makeup. Well, now with the development of the neurosciences, we can look into the brain, and we know exactly where the language centers of the brain are. It's the Wernicke's area, the Broca's area, the angular gyrus. You damage one of those parts, you bang your head, you get a tumor in that area, you'll lose some part of your linguistic ability. It's called an aphasia. So, proof that these behaviors are generating from within the brain. So I took that principle and applied it to the fact that every human culture, from the dawn of our species, no matter how isolated, has believed in some form of a spiritual realm.
Sun, the moon, something.
Something. Spirits, whatever. Some form of a spiritual reality, has prayed to something.
Right.
So suggesting that it must be built into us, that somewhere in the human brain, there must be parts of the brain, what I informally refer to as the God part of the brain, that compels us to have these spiritual beliefs and to create religions around those beliefs. So, again, so the universality is actually one of the proofs that there must be a part of the brain that generates these perceptions. Okay, so then there's the neurophysiological proof.
I don't know if that, listen, I don't know if that boils down to proof. That boils down to, here's what Matthew thinks.
Okay, well, in scientific terms, the science is basically, you use sociobiology as a validation. If you can find a behavior that's universal in an animal, most scientists will say that that's generally a sign that it's built into that creature. It's an inherited reflex.
But I could use the same argument, Matthew, to say the universal nature of it makes the other argument as well.
Okay, and again, we'll go there. This is all a warm up. I'm just building up the argument here, and then we can discuss sort of in detail. But yes.
Yeah, but when you say proof, I want to feel cinder blocks falling on my feet.
Okay, here comes some cinder blocks.
All right.
Okay. The next part is the neurophysiological argument, and this is now connecting. So here I am just building up to suggest that maybe this is in our heads, that maybe the fact that it's so universal would suggest that it's coming from part of the brain. So in the last 20-odd years or so, people have started putting people in the midst of prayer in MRIs.
Right.
They've done it with Franciscan nuns, Buddhist monks, and basically at this point, the hyper-religious of every belief system out there. And what they find is the same thing happens. If you meditate or pray, or you are in the midst of what you might call a religious or mystical experience. Okay, what happens if you're having one of these experiences based on the findings of MRIs is that a couple things happen. One, for instance, your brain's amygdala, part of the limbic system, which is responsible for generating fear and anxiety, gets a decreased blood flow. One of the universal descriptors of a spiritual experience is a sense of euphoria, bliss, tranquility. Normal fears and anxieties are dissipated. It relaxes us. So we kind of have like a built-in drug in our heads. If we think about
Stop for a second. Stop. Mm-hmm. You said a decreased blood flow to the amygdala.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What would science predict? What effect would science predict that a decreased blood flow to the would have?
Well, the amygdala is a part of the limbic system. It's part of our brain that generates fear and anxiety.
Exactly.
Okay, that's one of the symptoms. Another is the brain's parietal lobe, which is responsible for generating spatial and temporal consciousness, also gets a decreased blood flow. So we're left feeling this ethereal sense of timelessness and spacelessness. Our normal boundaries of reality start to wane, and we're left feeling. Then another symptom, the brain's right frontal lobe also decreased blood flow. They found that that's where, generally, where ego, where personality is generated. People who suffer from something called Pick's disease, which is a deterioration of that part of the brain, lose their normal sense of self. Their taste change, their sense of identity is altered. So when that part of the brain gets a decreased blood flow, our normal ego boundaries are dissipated. We no longer feel like me. We feel like one with the universe. So again, these are all physical things that happen if we meditate or pray that leave us feeling a certain way. So the brain is geared towards these behaviors to leave us in a certain state, to alter perception.
All right. I'm willing to concede these changes that you have described in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
However, what's wrong with suggesting that when you get in that state, when you get in a spiritual state, whatever it is you worship, that that entity is not producing these changes in your brain that are causing you to feel this way? I mean,
which entity? Because they've done these experiments on people from every religion. So it would mean that basically any belief we can come up with. If I believe in the great big bird in the sky, he must be real because I'm having the same effect as someone who's praying to Allah or Jesus.
Hail Big Bird.
Hail Big Bird. So, okay, that's point one. Then you've got this PSI, Dr. Ramachandran at UCLA, who found, he was doing research on epilepsy, and he found that there was a group of epileptics who suffered from what was called temporal lobe epilepsy. And people who suffered from this specific type of epilepsy, first of all, 25% of them tend towards hyper-religiosity. So he was finding that people who had temporal lobe epilepsy, one out of four of them were somehow coincidentally hyper-religious people. Moreover, they were reporting that during their seizures, they were having intense religious experiences. And as a matter of fact, reading from their Bible or hearing things that in any way reminded them of their religion, choir, choruses, or whatever, could stimulate the seizure, in which case they would come out of it feeling like that they had a religious experience. To support that, there are two scientists, two doctors, Saver and Rabin, also at UCLA, who were neuroscientists and historians and started looking back and doing some research and finding that a lot of the world's prophets suffered symptoms that seemed to indicate that they were potentially epileptics, from Joan of Arc to the Apostle Paul to Muhammad. In historical writings, there seems to be evidence that they suffered from epilepsy. Dostoevsky, for instance, who was an epileptic, he wrote in his book, The Idiot, and I quote, I have really touched God. He came into me. You healthy people cannot imagine the happiness we epileptics feel seconds before we suffer from one of our attacks. Again, all suggesting that this is a brain state, not like God literally entering these people, but that their brains, which albeit a little bit broken, somehow in that breakage, it's prompting, it's inducing a religious experience. But it's coming from a dysfunction.
I also believe, and I hate to help you here, but it is true that scientists have been able to electrically stimulate brains in certain areas and produce religious / spiritual experiences.
Right?
Yes. Even near death.
Yes. Well, that's a different phenomenon. What you're talking about is a transcranial magnetic stimulator, which electromagnetically stimulates specific points in the brain. And if you point it at, like, the temporal lobe, for instance, or some of these other parts, it can induce a religious experience, which eventually I'm going to get to with the whole ethnobotany, the last proof I'll go to, which is where people take certain drugs or plants to do the same thing, again, suggesting it's all chemical in nature. But back to the neurophysiological, the same person who was going around with this transcranial magnetic stimulator was also interviewing people, and in his interviews with high school students, he found that one out of five of them who reportedly, you know, said that they were very religious, had also reported that they suffered some type of traumatic brain injury during their lives. This coincides with the work of a Dr. Arnold Sadwin, the former chief of neuropsychiatry at University of Pennsylvania, who was doing research on something called organic psychosyndrome, basically people who suffer from traumatic brain injuries, and it alters their behaviors or their perceptions. He found that there were people, and he was one of the first people who wrote to me after hearing me on your show, saying, you know, I've been doing this research for years and you made it make sense, because I could never understand why families of people were saying, yeah, he suffered a head injury and suddenly he's super religious, or he was super religious and now he doesn't go to church or couldn't care less.
Right.
People can suffer from religious organic psychosyndromes, or if you're banged in the head, it can suddenly turn you into a hyper-religious person or a non-religious person, depending on where you started from. Again, all suggesting that these are just based on the mechanics of the brain as opposed to some ethereal reality beyond us. But it's all an extension, a manifestation of what's going on inside of our heads. So more or less, and, you know, I could keep going, but that's generally the work that's been done to suggest from a neurophysiological standpoint that, that again, God is in your head and not outside of it.
Have you done any research at all into why it is that people from New York and specifically Brooklyn irritate the hell out of people in the rest of the country?
It's an ongoing investigation. I'll let you know when we get results.
It really is true. I mean, on top of everything else, I remember on the old shows we had, I would get these emails afterwards raging. And then at the bottom, they'd always put in, "Isada, I can't stand his New York accent."
Yeah, well, sorry about that, people. Deal with it.
Yeah. Okay, now...
Okay,
You separate, mm-hmm. right, religious and spiritualism. Religion and spiritualism.
Well, basically, I write that there are two distinct instincts going on here. Two separate regions in the brain that are doing two separate things. So I basically break it into... the spiritual instinct and the religious instinct. So spirituality and religiosity are two separate things. So, yeah.
Separate part of the brain or same?
Separate parts of the brain. So, for instance, most of religiosity, people who really talk about their religion or God, like these temporal lobe epileptics, it seems to be coming from the temporal lobe, whereas the spiritual experience, which is a different thing, it's that sense of calm, of oneness with the universe, God consciousness, etc., that's based in a combination of, like, the amygdala, the parietal lobe. It's a different experience. So basically, there's two things coinciding at work here. You've got the capacity for us to have these experiences where our normal ego boundaries are reduced and we feel one with the world, one with the universe, maybe one with God. So through these experiences, we're left feeling that we're connected to something higher. So based on these feelings that prompt beliefs, we then, through the religious instinct, which is more responsible for creating political institutions, for creating laws and rituals and customs, for mythologies, for basically solidifying those spiritual experiences we have, which are more sensory in nature, and consolidating them into sort of a mythical paradigm, which has politics and customs and rituals and rules we have to abide by, which give us a sense of community, a sense of belonging, and a sense of purpose. So that's why you can have people who might report that they're very religious, they're very involved in going to church and the rituals, but they wouldn't necessarily describe themselves as spiritual. And you have other people who say, "I'm highly spiritual, but I'm not at all religious."
A lot of people say that.
Yeah. So meaning they can connect with the experience of, like, the oneness with the universe, and that if they meditate or pray, it relaxes them. They feel, you know, they feel one with God.
All right. They cannot embrace God, but they can embrace some form of spiritual.
Well, in some cases, it might be God. It doesn't mean that spirituality negates God. It just means that you believe in some aspect of a spiritual realm, but you might not abide by any particular rituals. You might not feel you need to go to church or confess to a priest or any of the above, but you still feel that you're connected to the spiritual realm.
All right, so if we were to examine your brain, we would find your amygdala flooded with blood constantly, right?
You'd probably just be like Bugs Bunny chasing a turtle.
You know, I'm actually not really trying to be funny here. It seems to me that if you can prove one thing, then you should be able to take somebody such as yourself, a true non-believer,
And prove
the other and show the blood flow continues as normal. There's no lessening. You're not relaxing. You're going 100 miles an hour, as usual.
You only lead me to chapter 12. Why are there atheists?
All right. Let's jump to chapter 12.
Okay.
Why are there?
Okay. Well, basically, for every physical trait we possess, we fall into a bell curve. You take any given population, let's say a random sample of 1,000 people, and you measure them, let's say, a physical trait like height. Basically, the majority will fall into the category of what we will call average height, the bulge of the bell curve, and on the tapering extremes, there might be 10%, let's say, who are shorter than the norm and 10% that are taller than the norm. Again,
I have a bulging bell curve. I have a bulging bell curve.
Well, I'm sure that makes your wife very happy.
No, that's not that one. Anyway.
Okay. Anyway, so let's take something, a more abstract trait like musicality. Same thing. You take a random sampling of 1,000 people from any culture and you investigate their musical abilities. And you'll find the same bell curve will ensue. that the average person, the majority of people that you poll, have what we would call average musical intelligence or musical ability. They can hum a tune. If you clap in rhythm, they can copy you. But on the tapering extremes, they're going to be, let's say, 15% on either side who are going to be either tone deaf on one end and musical savants on the extreme of the other.
All right. I don't think it makes any difference. Now, for example, I have zero musical talent, Matthew. Mm-hmm. However, I would report to you this. When I listen to music that I love, I have something that approximates a spiritual experience.
Okay. I fall into a similar category. But again, musicality, it's a complex trait. It's not just one thing. So there's ability to comprehend music. Like, there might be someone who's a genius as a music critic, but he'll never play a tune. You know, you give him a guitar and you might as well give it to my cat. So,
but I'm saying it's kind of like a spiritual experience. It really is very close to it. It changes your outlook on life. You can sit and listen to music and go from an angry state to a relaxed state to perhaps even a joyous state.
Okay. Well, I'm not an expert on musical consciousness and musical intelligence, but their whole book's written on it. They've done the same kind of MRI experiments, and absolutely, music changes the brain.
There you go.
Yeah, you listen to a John Philip Sousa march, and you get people riled up, and they go out and they fight for you. You play, you know, some more peaceful, contemplative classical music, and it relaxes people, or they feel sad. So music can generate all these various emotions, but generally speaking, let's say in terms of musical talent, the same bell curve emerges. Again, it's a physical trait. It comes from a part of the brain, and that's a result of genetic variance. We're all different. We all, you know, but we fall within a curve for every physical trait. The same thing applies to spirituality and religiosity. So though the majority of the world, of our species, has what we could call average spiritual / religious intelligence, an average capacity to believe in something, to pray to something, on the tapering extremes, you have a portion of any given population who are going to be hyper-religious. They're going to be the people, you know, given heartfelt sermons at the pulpit at 10 years old. They've got the spirit born into them. And then on the other extreme, you're going to have people who just are religiously tone deaf. They don't get it. They don't care. It doesn't play any interest in their life. They're more interested in going fishing, fixing.
All right. Well, we are going to close this hour of Coast to Coast AM. So, with that being said, good night, everybody. We'll see you on Monday. Next Monday, part 2 with Matthew Alford.